is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
Well, what does a failed foreign policy look like? What does a failed foreign policy look like? Well, it may come in the form of an official directive from Russia ordering U.S. planes out of Syria. And that's exactly what has happened. Russian officials are demanding that American warplanes exit Syrian airspace immediately. Senior U.S. officials are confirming that to Fox News now. U.S. military sources telling Fox that U.S. warplanes would not comply with the Russian demand. Russian planes now flying over Syrian airspace as well. How long until there's an incident? Certainly something to concern ourselves with. There's nothing to indicate that we're changing our operations over Syria at this point, but the Russians have demanded that we leave. Another defense official adding, "We have had every indication in recent weeks that the Russians were going to do something given the buildup." Now, let me direct your attention back to 2012. May of 2012, when Barack Obama said, "No problem. We don't need to enforce the red line. We're fine. We're going to work with our Russian friends to remove Bashar al-Assad as president of Syria." Wrong. You see, Assad and Russia are close allies, and frankly, always have been. And this whole teacher's lounge mentality for foreign policy doesn't work in the real world as a general rule. Look at the Taliban taking villages in Kunduz province in Afghanistan. Look at the collapse in Iraq and the expansion of ISIL. You see, you could sit there and tell the world it looks great from the teacher's lounge perspective, the view from the lofty teacher's lounge where they can pontificate about the rights and wrongs of the world and the evils of America. But in practical application, this president's foreign policy is an abject failure. Now, this move by Moscow marks a major escalation in ongoing tensions between the two countries over military action in the war-torn region and comes moments after Russian lawmakers formally approved a request from Vladimir Putin to authorize the use of troops in Syria. You see, Russia's moving in, and they do not intend to leave. The Russian demand comes after a very similar demand made by Turkey in July when Ankara asked U.S. planes to fly only in airspace south of Mosul. In that case, 24 Turkish jets bombed Kurdish positions, catching the U.S. off guard. The Turks went ahead and bombed the Kurds that are on our side. Now the Russians are saying, get out. If only we could hit the reset button with Russia, wouldn't that be great? If only of those of you listening right now, that decided not to vote for Mitt Romney because he wasn't conservative enough for you, or there's something else you didn't like about him. He's too soft. You ought to be ashamed of yourselves. Mitt Romney knew exactly what he was talking about. He was spot on and accurate. He called Russia for what it was and what it is and what it shall continue to be, which is our major number one adversary on the world stage. Barack Obama ridiculed him in the 2012 presidential debates. The 1980s called, and they want their foreign policy back. The Cold War is over. The Cold War may have been dormant, but the Cold War is alive and well today, I'm here to tell you. And it's not that cold. So for those of you that decided not to vote for Mitt Romney for whatever misguided reason you had, shame on you. And for anybody that doesn't get out to vote for a change in the White House this time around, I would only have contempt for that. The only way we can set this country back on the proper trajectory is to take our country back from those that have sent it down this path. I am not proud of our foreign policy, are you? In retrospect, we never should have gone to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Certainly shouldn't have stayed the way we did. And we did have no exit strategy. George W. Bush led what I thought was an appropriate war at the time, but in retrospect, you have to wonder about several points of that war. But you don't have to be second-guessing about what happened since Barack Obama took office. No, it's pretty clear that's been an abject failure. Remember Vice President Joe Biden saying this was going to be one of the great achievements of the Obama administration? What happened in Iraq and Afghanistan going forward? What would happen in Iraq and Afghanistan going forward would be one of the great achievements, he said in 2010. Not seeing much of an achievement now are we? Meanwhile, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, appearing yesterday on CBS This Morning, said that Russian President Vladimir Putin's plan to work with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's current government to fight ISIS is a phony solution. Here it is.
He has done appalling things in his country. He's massacred hundreds of thousands of his own citizens. Millions have fled. And so in my view, you know, he has broken international law and he has to go. And I know there are some people who are thinking, well, look, you know, ISIL is even worse than Assad. So shouldn't we somehow cut a deal with Assad to team up and take on ISIL?
That's the Russian president's
position. Sounds enticing. But even if you thought it was the right thing to do, which it isn't, it wouldn't work because, you know, Assad
so
is
you were saying get rid of Assad first before you continue the attack?
You need to do both. You need to do both. So, we need a Syria free of ISIL and Assad. The point I'm making is Assad is one of the recruiting sergeants for ISIL. Because of what he's done to his people, that is one of the reasons why people are flocking to ISIL to fight for ISIL. So that method that some put forward wouldn't work. We need a Syria free of both.
And America needs a foreign policy with some forward thinking. But instead, we're firing generals, stripping our military, gutting the operation, and pontificating from the teacher's lounge with some fat-free yogurt, I suppose. Time for some real leadership in America. It is time for some real leadership in America. It's 14 after. What are your thoughts? 888-900-9966. 888-900-9966, the phone number to check it out. You can find out more at stevegruber.com as well. You can listen live there. You can check out podcasts, and you can send a note along for me to review and possibly use right here on the program. It's Wednesday. We'll be right back.
Covering Michigan and the world from his bunker below the bridge, here is Steve Gruber.
Wow, you don't get something from nothing. You get freedom for free. You won't get wise with the sleeves still in your eyes, no matter what your dream might be.
All right, hotline is open. 888-900-9966. I'll crack it open for you. We got a couple of calls on the last couple of topics, so why not? Feel free, be somebody. The phone number, 888-900-9966. That's 888-900-9966, the Common Sense Hotline. Ellis, on the line from Grand Rapids. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Steve.
Good to have you.
Comment is basically, it's like a Sunni-Shiite thing. You know, the U.S. kind of siding with Saudi Arabia, who are mainly Sunnis, and the Iran Shiites, and Assad, the Alawite, former Shiite. But, you know, was Muhammad a Sunni or a Shia? You know, what are they fighting about? That's my commoner question.
What are we fighting about? It's a good question, Alice. I mean, here's the thing. At the end of the day, aren't you a little bit embarrassed that Vladimir Putin is dictating to America, this is what you will do? Don't you seem a little unsettled by that?
Embarrassed is one adjective I would use. There's other ones, but he needs a warm water port on the Mediterranean, you know, and if Assad goes, he says, like Crimea, we need these warm water ports.
Yeah.
And if the U.S. wants to, you know, but the planes flying over Syria, that's a major issue if they tell us to get out.
Which is exactly what just happened. So my point being is, you're going to have MiG-25s, you know, and F-16s commingling, you know, talk about a recipe for disaster.
Okay. What about China sending an aircraft carrier or something over there? I read yesterday.
Yeah, you know, through the Suez.
I didn't read the news today yet.
Yeah, they're sending the, you know, the Chinese now have a blue water navy, which includes flat tops. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Put it all.
I
want to
hear other people's comments, so I'm going to get going here.
All right, Alice. Thanks for chiming in.
Okay. Bye.
There you have it. 888-900-9966. 888-900-9966. And we'll keep right on down the list. We've got John on the line in Portage. John, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Steve. We are in a mess with the Russians dictating to us. But the problem we're in is those that have been a long time in government in one sense or another, including our current governor, get things all mixed up and backwards. Now, the present governor of Michigan, Rich Snyder, wants to bring in refugees. Now, we're about facing a war. We have a tremendous deficit, and we've got the governor of a state who isn't busy enough with things, so that he now wants to get involved with the refugee issue and the immigration issue.
Do you think we should have anything to do with the refugees or the immigration issue, or should that just be, you know, up to the Middle East, up to the Europeans to deal with? What is your take on it overall, John?
Well, my analysis is that those that have been long-standing in government, including Kasich, who's been there since age 26, and I know you have you see a lot of favorable things. I don't say that you select him, but you see a lot of favorable things to him, and I don't see a lot of favorable things. I see him as a big government guy, and I see Snyder as a big government guy, even though I supported Snyder.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you something,
evil
John.
Evil of lessers.
This is really important. Let me ask you this. Did you vote for Mitt Romney?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, then Mitt Romney, the guy that brought, you know, government health care from Massachusetts, isn't he a big government guy as well?
Well, allow me to say it again. The evil of lessers.
Well, that's my point. So I guess my question to you is, if Kasich's on the ticket, if he wins through, for example, would you support him?
Oh, sure.
That's my question. I appreciate it. John, thanks for checking in.
Would I support him? I'm not foolish, but I would also support a third-party candidate if I thought the third-party candidate was good.
Well, yeah, but the problem with that is third-party candidates have only ever hurt Republicans. It was true in 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt did it.
I understand that, but if the Republican and the Democrat equal what we currently have in government on both sides, okay, I'll cast my dissent vote.
Right, but see, the problem with that thinking, John, in my estimation, is that casting a dissent vote usually is a vote for the Democrats. I mean, Bill Clinton won the White House twice, the only guy in the 20th century to win the White House twice, and never got 50% of the vote. And you want to know why? Because people cast votes like yours, saying, you know, a dissent vote or whatever you want to call it. That's why Bill Clinton was president twice, without ever getting 50% of the vote.
I think part of what you say is right, but there is a part of it that isn't right. And part of it was that the Republicans never attacked Bill Clinton on where he was weak, about his slickness, where he was trying to deceive people. They never called him Slick Willie. They never attacked him on that basis and all. They gave him a pass.
I mean, everybody attacked him on that. I mean, he never got 50%.
That's right.
But the reason he never got 50% and became the president not once but twice, it's because of protest votes just like that. John, I got to run, my friend. Thank you for checking in. It's 24 after the hour. The phone number here. We might be able to sneak one more in if we had a chance. 888-900-9966. 888-900-9966. And historically speaking, it's always the same. Third-party candidates generally hurt the Republican. It was true when Teddy Roosevelt ran in 1912. It was certainly true when Ross Perot ran in 1992. I mean, I suppose you could say that George Wallace helped Richard Nixon get elected, and you could dissect that. George Wallace carried, what, 7 states in 1968? Something like that. And Richard Nixon won, but then Richard Nixon won in a tremendous landslide in 1972. So all it requires is some reading of some unrevised history, some actual history. You might be well served, by the way. I do this sometimes. Go find older history books, not ones that are online, and see what people are writing about history in 1960 or 70 or 80, and look at actual history books that weren't indoctrinated and impregnated with garbage like they are today, or revised and revamped to fit a narrative that was not true then and certainly isn't true today. You know, you're well served to read and check your sources, is my point. Make sure you read good sources and have good information, because if it's not good information coming in, how could it possibly be good information on the way out the backside? 25 after on a Wednesday. It's the Steve Gruber Show. We'll be right back.
Genuine Michigan common sense on display every day.
It sounds like a way to get after us for more taxes. Alex asked me in the break here. He said, what's the problem with Uber? And I'm like, I have no idea. I don't think there's any problem with Uber whatsoever. Uber being a system where people that have cars and time on their hands, can, you know, get calls from other people that don't have cars and have a limited amount of time to get somewhere they need to be, you know, especially like in rural areas and so forth, in areas that, you know, that aren't serviced by taxi cab companies and so forth. But make no mistake, here comes the government. Oh, we need to regulate this. You know, Bill de Blasio, the genius running New York City, anything that looks like free market, he'll destroy, you know, on his way to the perfect socialist model for a city, which is another failure. At any rate, Kevin Gardner here, the state director of the Michigan for Generation Opportunity. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me on this morning.
So what is wrong with Uber? I mean, I like it. It's somebody, you know, got an idea. They used modern technology to create an opportunity, not only for themselves, but for a whole host of people that were, you know, people that want to work, people that want to go to work. They're not looking for a government handout. They're looking for a chance to go make a check and earn some money. And naturally, they get put right in the crosshairs. Why?
Yeah, so I think the sharing economy and companies like Uber and Lyft have been making headlines in places like New York, but people don't know that this battle is happening right here in Michigan. And what we're seeing is a war on the sharing economy and outdated business models, and politicians that aren't getting their piece of the pie don't know how to react to this new economy. So right now we're seeing that they're doing what they do best, which is to try to overregulate and push towards protectionism and cronyism.
So they do what they do best, which is destroy liberty, prevent freedom. You know, it's weird. People just say, well, you can do what you want. It's a free country. You know, America's not a free country anymore. You can't do anything. You can't go to the bathroom, literally, because you can only use 1.6 gallons of water by law. I mean, you can't do anything in this country without the government looking right over your shoulder, holding your hands, or telling you no and swatting you on the nose with a newspaper. It's disgusting to me.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, innovative companies like Uber and Lyft should be allowed to allow the opportunity to freely operate here in Michigan and in any city or state. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is local taxi companies have been lobbying state governments to force them out of the marketplace. And so now we're seeing the Michigan State Senate trying to fit ride-sharing companies into an outdated regulatory structure that doesn't work for 21st century businesses. So what they really need to be doing is making the regulations fit the business model, not the other way around.
Maybe there shouldn't be any regulations at all. Maybe they shouldn't make regulations fit anything. Maybe they should just get the hell out of the way, let people prosper, let people use innovative ideas to create new sectors in the economy that moves more money around, because the more money that moves, the better the economy is and the better overall we all are. Maybe they should just get out of the way altogether and leave it be.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, they should be letting consumers decide which services they want in a free and fair marketplace, and not politicians. But you know, the reality is there's going to be some regulation in this area, and we've got two competing trains of thought right now.
Well, what regulations? Hold on, Kevin. What regulations could we possibly need? I mean, here's the thing. Is the government going to tell me that if my neighbor gives me a ride to the airport in his private car, and I pay him to do that, that somehow that's going to be illegal unless he has, you know, gone through some sort of a government regulation and registration and so on and so forth?
Yeah, so, I mean, no matter what industry we're in, the government is trying to get their hands in the piece of the pie. And, you know, I'm right there with you. I want the government to get out of the way. But what we've got right now in the Michigan legislature is a package of bills in the House that, if passed, would create a reasonable statewide standard that would allow ride-sharing companies like Uber and Lyft to operate and to freely provide these services without excessive government involvement. And then we've got a package of Senate bills that is going to try and regulate Uber and Lyft differently in each local city or township, and also require drivers to be 21 years old, which really hurts the millennial generation.
Well, you know, the government, at some point, young entrepreneurs, you know, are going to be extinct, obsolete, because, you know, unfortunately, it seems that we're indoctrinating most young people in this country to believe that somehow government creates jobs and government's the answer. And so people that want to work for themselves and create opportunity. You know, I did a lot of research on some African-American ladies in southern states that were doing hair braiding and so forth. And they weren't allowed to in Mississippi and Alabama and elsewhere because in order to, you know, to do hair, you had to have a cosmetology license. So you had to go to school and spend $10,000 and spend a year and a half in school, though there was nothing about traditional hair braiding for African-American hair at any of the schools taught. So they fought back, and they won. And this is the type of model we need here. We need to fight back and say, no, we don't need regulation here. If someone wants to drive somebody around in their own private car, that's their own damn business. If someone wants to braid their neighbor's hair and get paid for it because they want to work and they're not looking for a government handout or a government check, we ought to let people work. We ought to get the government out of the way, and that goes for the Republicans as well as the Democrats. Leave it alone. Leave it be and let people go to work. What is wrong with people working and making a living and supporting their families without government coming in and interfering?
Absolutely, and I think that's where Generation Opportunity comes in. We are a grassroots movement of young Americans that are holding our elected officials accountable and promoting free market policies to improve the lives of the millennial generation. And we're going to be stuck with these policies. So already the deck is really stacked against the millennial generation. We're seeing double-digit youth unemployment, historic levels of student loan debt, and entitlement programs that we are never going to be able to use, that we have to pay into, like Social Security and Obamacare.
That's right.
So we really need to stand up and galvanize and get together here and tell politicians, hey, we're not going to put up with this anymore. You need to start listening to us and hold our best interests in mind.
Right, and so here's the government solution. So you're a 20, we'll use an example. Here's a 25-year-old guy. He's got $50,000 in student debt. He's paying $500 a month to pay off that debt for the next however many years. He decides to use his own private car, a car that he paid for, maintains, takes care of, puts gas in, changes the oil on, to give people rides to make a living to pay off his student debt so it isn't stuck to the taxpayers. And the government says, no, you can't do that. That's how foolish this all is. I'll give you the last word, Kevin.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Here in Michigan, if we want to keep young people in the state and stop the brain drain, lawmakers need to embrace this new sharing economy. Young people in the state of Michigan now are creating their own opportunities. We are not in the same economy that our parents were, so I really hope that government is going to get out of the way and listen to young people and create an economy where young people can thrive here in the state of Michigan.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, Kevin. Kevin Gardner, state director for the Generation Opportunity here in Michigan. Kevin, good conversation. Look forward to talking to you sometime soon.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
There you have it. Kevin Gardner, everybody. It's Generation Opportunity. Get off of our backs. Most of us are willing to work. Just get out of the way. Thank you.
Delivering Michigan common sense with a big dose of truth and honesty.
So I was in church this past weekend. Often am. I was in church this past weekend, and it occurred to me, listening to the pastor, how do Christian Democrats rationalize second and third term abortions? Seriously, how do Christian Democrats, and I was in the pew with two hardcore Christians, hardcore Democrats, how do these two things match up? I'm lost, and I've never asked about the abortion thing because I just haven't, out of respect their family, so I didn't ask, and I didn't want to go down that road with them. But how do Democrats make that work? How do they rationalize in their brains that it's okay to vote for Democrats who openly support, you know, abortion anytime, and no matter how late, on demand? David Azarad is a PhD and director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for Principles and Politics at the Heritage Foundation. Maybe he can help me. David, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So how do you answer that question? How do you get a Christian Democrat, and there are millions that are hardcore, you know, Christians, but that are Democrats, and the term, I'll just use abortion. To me, there's just no way to get these two to work in conjunction with each other, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, the first thing I would say, Steve, is I would commend you for not posing the question to them. One thing I dislike about living in Washington is how everything is politicized all the time, and I think it eats away at civic comedy. It makes us feel that we're no longer all citizens, but we're always divided in clans, and I think your judgment is right in that case. In terms of how to answer your question, look, I don't know. I'm Jewish. I have the same question in terms of how some of the Jews in this country vote in terms of how to square these two things. I can't look into the souls of other people and give an account of what goes on in there. What I will say is I think you approach it the right way. Is the question to raise is, how is it that we tolerate elective late-term abortions? One card I like to play in talking with these people is people on the left are usually enamored with Sweden. Sweden is the perfect country in the world. If only we could be more like Sweden. This is the constant refrain. One thing I tell them is Sweden doesn't allow elective late-term abortions. We are one of only seven countries in the world, we're up there with North Korea and China, that allows elective late-term abortions. So setting aside what you think about the first trimester, can't we all agree that we should do away with that? And I found that these arguments kind of plant a seed of doubt in the minds of people, and that they may not concede the point to you immediately, but they kind of start to mull it over. It is deeply disturbing when you look at it this way, that we are really an outlier in the international community, which is usually what the left likes to compare us to.
No, you know, that's interesting that you point out that on the subject of abortion, North Korea and China, you know, these are not people we want to align ourselves with when it comes to human rights and looking out for the underdog. What bigger underdog is there except for somebody, a fetus for that matter? But there are other places you can compare and contrast, correct?
But you'll find, Canada is one of them. But I think none of the Western European democracies allow elective late-term abortions. I could be wrong, but essentially all the countries that are supposedly more progressive than us, that have a better political system, supposedly larger welfare states, and that we should be emulating in a whole host of ways, seem to have a more robust moral compass than we do on this question.
All right, so why is there this fascination with Sweden? And it's not just about abortion; it's about renewable energy. It's about a whole host of things. It's about social programs. It's about how much money people are allowed to make, and so on and so forth. First of all, Sweden's a small country. There is no fair comparison to America, but people do it anyway. You're right.
Well, that's the key thing. You just hit the nail on the head. Look, I have nothing against Sweden. I mean, it's a fine country for Swedes. But to compare America to Sweden is silly. America isn't a country. It's a continent. Just look at a map. It contains tremendous geographical, cultural, and ethnic and religious diversity, something that Sweden doesn't have to deal with. If we want to compare ourselves to anyone, if anything, we might compare ourselves to Canada, although even there, the population of Canada is a tenth of ours. I don't know, maybe we compare ourselves to Brazil or to Russia or to China, to these very, very big countries. And we can learn from other countries. We shouldn't think that we're the best at everything. I mean, we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. This is another area where I think Sweden is better than this. But on the whole, I think the proper way to think of politics is to be anchored in your own country. No two countries are alike. We have a distinctive history, a distinctive culture. We should learn to others, look at others, try to learn from them as possible. But this idea that you can somehow recreate one country in another, it's the height of foolishness.
Yeah, I think you're right. The height of foolishness. And it seems to me that we have this whole teacher's lounge mentality, you know, because I think that, you know, we're allowing people to espouse their beliefs and their views based on nothing more than the musings of their own mind and having never lived among the rest of us in what we call the real world. And I believe that. I believe that there are academics that have, you know, amused themselves in an academic world in almost a pretend way and never been out among the rest of us that are, you know, scratching to make a living every day. David, I'll give you the last word.
Look, we're all enamored with theory because there's something appealing about theory because a 22-year-old can sit down who doesn't know the first thing about life, understand three principles, and then claim to be an expert in any given field. I'm an expert in poverty relief. I'm an expert in marriage because I studied it and I did a master's or I teach it in a university. The truth of the matter is, of course, there's some room from theory, but theory usually comes after experience. Who came up with these theories are people who've spent a long time on the ground, understand statesmanship, understand civil society, understand marriage, and then they, with great difficulty, managed to distill what they've learned over the course of a lifetime. That's the type of theory I admire, not the one that a 22-year-old with no experience espouses.